Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Our everyday lives are increasingly becoming intertwined with high-speed internet access. Everything from submitting homework to getting groceries. And that reality is almost certain to only to grow. Yet millions of Americans living in rural areas can't access broadband affordably or at all. Millions more in urban areas are not in the game. And day by day, it matters more. This hour on Point, closing the digital divide. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Should we treat broadband internet access now like electricity? Make it basically available to everybody. How do we do that? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Not hard to find the headlines. A quarter of the nation without broadband. Here's the FCC chair under Donald Trump, Ajit Pai. This is in April at an event hosted by FreedomWorks, talking about the future of internet access and regulation.
Whether I'm in red America, purple America, or blue America, whether I'm in the permafrost above the Arctic Circle or in the bayous of Louisiana, people tell me the same thing. They want fast, affordable, and reliable internet access. They say they want the benefits that come from competition. And they tell me that they want to access the content and use the applications, services, and devices of their choice. The question that we at the FCC must answer is what policies will give the American people what they want.
There's a lot in there, but let's look first at access. Joining me first today from New York is Claire Malone, senior political writer at 538. Her recent piece is headlined, "The Worst Internet in America." She's talking rural internet. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Claire Malone, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
You're looking at rural broadband internet access, at urban. You've got reporting coming up on urban access as well. Can we just start with this? A lot of Americans didn't have broadband for a long time. We all remember that weird little sound and the hookup of the modem and all that. And people limped along with that for years. Why? And now people are saying, well, maybe everybody should have it the same way that, you know, we really pushed to get phones and electricity to everyone. What's the case for that? That it's that important that the country should have policies that push access to all?
Well, for so many people, so many parts of their lives are sort of by necessity online now. You know, we'll often have paychecks that are direct deposited. You often apply for college or jobs online. You find information increasingly online rather than in paper form. And for those of us who live in cities or suburban or urban areas, it's really easy for us to have easy internet access. You can go to a library or you have your own devices. But if it's not readily available to you, you are falling behind in a certain way in 21st century America. And, you know, this is something that maybe we should consider, you know, what we call basic infrastructure in the 21st century, basic utilities in the 21st century. Does it now include fast internet in addition to electricity and telephones, which weren't an expected utility back in the 30s before FDR decided to do—
They were a luxury at one time.
Exactly, yeah. And before FDR decided to do rural electrification and said, hey, all Americans, even the people who are living on farms, should have access to electricity. And, you know, hindsight is 20/20. Looking back 80 years, we now all know that having electricity on farms and everywhere in America is a social and economic good. And I think we might look back and say the same for broadband internet.
I mean, you say in cities access is easy. Well, an awful lot of people in cities don't have that access. I know you've been looking at that as well. We'll look at urban access and what keeps people from having broadband access. Let's go first rural. Maybe before we dive in, we should define what is broadband access. How fast, how strong?
They call it 25 up, 3 down. So 25 megabytes to upload something and 3 to download something, and which basically just means that's a fancy way of saying the kind of fast internet that you can stream videos on, that you can use multiple devices with on the same home connection. So it's basically you're not waiting for things to buffer or load. You're able to sort of use that internet without thinking about, oh, this is loading, this is annoying, I can't, you know, get access to this. So it's just a baseline measurement that the FCC has said is this is sort of the gold standard of what we think this this utility should be.
You write about 39% of rural Americans, according to the FCC. That's 23 million people without that kind of access. Where are they?
They're all over. You know, if you look at a map in our piece, we have a really, you know, beautiful map visualization. And you can see that a lot of the areas that don't have internet access are often in the West, you know, big expanses of land. You can think like that. But they're also all over in every single state in the country. So actually, the idea for the story for me came when I was in Aroostook County, Maine, which is way northern Maine, up by Canada, and was talking to, you know, a local politician who said it's really hard to FaceTime with your grandchildren who live in other states because Maine has a huge problem of young people leaving their state. He said, you know, that really affects quality of life for a lot of people out here, that they can't have a connection with their family. So it's everywhere in America. It's rural areas. And, you know, this is one reason why when, you know, you talk to a lot of people, broadband advocates, they'll say, this last election, a lot of people in rural America, we talked a lot about the disconnection that people felt. Some of it's literal disconnection, you know, the idea that they feel left behind in certain ways.
You'd write about what you headlined, the worst internet in America. Where's that? Describe it.
It's in Sawatch County, Colorado, according to a statistical model that we came up with that looked at all the counties in the United States and sort of parsed it out. And we according to our model, Sawatch County, which is a beautiful, beautiful county in the San Luis Valley, which is sort of 4 hours southwest of Denver. It's mostly agricultural. It's in between two big mountain ranges. And it's got, you know, sort of a large Hispanic population. It's a bit it's got, you know, a little bit of a hippie subculture there. There's now marijuana grow operations there. So it's actually not necessarily maybe what people's stereotype of what, you know, a rural America looks like. It's pretty diverse, and it's got a lot of different things going on. But they are all sort of connected by this fact that the geography of their county makes it very difficult to lay fiber optic cable, which is what fast internet relies on. And also, it's a pretty poor county overall.
And so what's broadband access look like there?
Well, if you live closer to the main thoroughfares, the highways, you might have some fast internet. But once you get up towards, you know, the outerlying mountain towns, most people get internet that is that doesn't go through the ground, but is through airwaves. So they call it fixed wireless internet. So people will have these little satellite dish looking dishes on their house. And your house has to be within a line of sight of a big tower to beam the internet to you. And they, if you want to get sort of the sort of speeds that are faster that you might expect in New York City or Boston, you need to pay a lot of money. So I might pay $30 for very fast internet in New York. They might pay $90. So it's really an issue of cost as well, not just access.
What would it cost? I mean, this is a big country, and Colorado's got big counties, and you've got a very sparse population. That's a lot of wire for a few people. Now, maybe people made the same argument about electricity back in the day. But is it economically feasible to lay fiber optic cable to every cabin and outlying farm in Colorado or the country?
So there are some places in the San Luis Valley that are trying to lay fiber optic cable everywhere, but it's likely that rural internet won't be all fiber-based. So a lot of this fixed wireless, this internet through the air, might be what happens. But when we're talking about, you know, what is needed to make this kind of internet happen in rural America, there is some infrastructure that's already out there. And when you talk to experts, they say we want to really avoid replication, people getting really excited and just going out and building lots of new lines. They say, let's give maybe $10 or $20 billion for initial upfront capital investments. So give small companies, small rural electric co-ops cash and sort of have them do the best job for their little area instead of parsing out subsidies over the years annually. So a lot of people have talked about connecting what they call anchor institutions, so hospitals, libraries, schools, you know, places that will make it easier for kids to do homework after school, or let's say to do telemedicine sessions for veterans. You know, rural America has a really large percentage of veterans, many of whom have mental health needs that might not be available in their areas. So a lot of it is about first trying to connect these big institutions that small towns have and need to have a lot of people have access to. But it does involve a certain amount of upfront investment to enable these connections to happen.
Are there technology solutions that might make this easier? It's eluding me now, but was it Google or Amazon that was talking about floating balloons over Africa that would beam Wi-Fi access down, if I remember that correctly? I mean, is there some whiz-bang technical solution for the U.S. to get, you know, universal access?
Unfortunately, I don't think there is. I mean, you know, one very simple thing is that some towns would maybe like to have free Wi-Fi in their town center. That's one thing. But a lot of this is really just the kind of the plug and chug of making sure that these satellite dishes are on houses, or that, you know, seeing if you can lay, maybe if you don't lay fiber optic cable in the ground, maybe you try to see if you can lay it over telephone poles. A lot of it really is just kind of pretty straightforward. But, you know, fiber optic cable is expensive. I was talking to one rural electric co-op that was trying to buy fiber, and they said, you know, there's a wait time because Google buys up all the fiber in the United States, you know. So there's it's a little bit of a scarcity of resources thing, too, for these small companies.
And Ajit Pai, the head of the FCC now, is he really committed to having this out there for everybody? Or what's his play?
Well, you know, I think the FCC is a little bit hamstrung by the political process in Washington. So there was, you know, the FCC right now is kind of into regulating. If there were to be, say, an infrastructure project that was undertaken in Congress to provide not just roads and bridges, but also perhaps broadband, you know, fiber access, there's a lot of talk about what agency would sort of administer funds. And perhaps that would be the FCC. But, you know, there was during the Obama administration, the Recovery Act, there was some movement to give to provide internet funds to rural areas. But a lot of people feel that those funds were sort of in a lot of places wasted or, you know, just mismanaged. So there's some bureaucratic wrangling to be done.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the digital divide as everything moves online. Who has broadband internet access and who doesn't in America's countryside, in its cities? And what to do about it? Claire Malone is with us, senior political writer at 538. She's been looking into who has and who doesn't, just how big the internet deserts out there are. And they're pretty large, rural and urban. Of course, if you're on, you've taken it for granted for years, may not seem like a problem at all, but a lot of people are not. And it can be tough, given the way the world is going. You can join the conversation. Are you one of the 23 million rural Americans without broadband? How could we get it to you? What would make sense? Are you one of the millions of urban Americans without real access? What's putting real broadband internet action out of reach for you? In Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in June, President Trump said that he would push to include broadband access in his infrastructure bill.
I will be including a provision in our infrastructure proposal, $1 trillion proposal. You'll be seeing it very shortly. To promote and foster enhanced broadband access for rural America also.
Okay, great. So far, that infrastructure bill not exactly making a lot of progress, not really up on the rails. And it's not just rural. Here's Christina. She's a mom to four kids in Miami-Dade County. She brings her kids to the public library for internet access for them to do their homework. Lots of teachers now presume that that's how it will get done. But, of course, you don't always have time to get that child to the library to do their homework. Here's an interview with Fusion. She explains why her family doesn't have broadband at home.
I just basically couldn't afford it because making the $9, $10 an hour, I could barely even pay rent. I can barely pay rent. I can barely pay my phone bill. There's times where I can't put gas in the car. When you don't make enough money to begin with, it's just not a priority.
But there are her kids with their homework to do and more going online. Claire Malone joins us from New York. I want to go to Colorado right now, out closer to the region Claire writes about, and to Betsy Blecka, who brought all this to our attention. She proposed today's show topic on rural broadband access, anyway, through our On Point Listens page, part of our 2017 National Listening Tour. You should check all that out at the website onpointradio.org. Betsy Bleck is Jackson County Commissioner in Colorado, county up in northern Colorado, up by the Wyoming border there. As of the 2010 census, Jackson County's population was the fourth least densely populated in Colorado. Just 1,394 residents in that census. Betsy Blecka in Walden, Colorado, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
You poked us in the ribs and said, hey, On Point, pay attention to this. Why do you think this needs attention, Betsy?
Well, at the time that I reached out to you, we were having some issues with our local large carrier. As a county, In rural Colorado, counties provide a lot of the government services that municipalities usually do in larger communities. Mm-hmm. And so after having the county residents repeal Colorado Senate Bill 152, that allowed municipalities and government agencies to local government agencies to work with other entities to create networks and engage in contracts to provide broadband service. After years and years of trying to lobby our local carrier from boards prior to mine for at least the last 10 years with no show, we kind of wanted to go on our own way. We reached out to different entities to try to create a better broadband service for our community. But with what your guest Claire there is saying, you know, there's a lot of barriers to providing access to rural communities, a lot of that being cost. And when we were trying to work with private companies, cost always became the factor. And so when I reached out to you, it was kind of our Hail Mary pass because we were at a standstill because nobody wanted to work with us.
Is anything moving or shaking? Do you see something that will bring broadband to your all or most or a bunch of your very rural population there, Betsy?
Well, in fact, it has. From the time I reached out to you until this point, we've actually made a lot of progress. We've reached out to a company in Nebraska that's going to provide wireless service to our community. Not only is it's going to create competition, but it's also going to provide higher speed and increase our coverage area. So the folks in the outlying areas who are using satellite service can now maybe use some more reliable wireless. And then in addition, our local our electric utility co-op is looking into bringing fiber to all of its customers. But the reason this is all happening is because these companies want to work and support rural communities. They're not doing it for the money.
What's their incentive to go into rural communities?
They want to keep our community sustainable, to keep it going. You know, we share a lot of our services with our neighboring counties, and it's kind of the benefit of the whole. You know, as you mentioned, we have a very small population. We're less than one person per square mile.
Wow.
And we're the smallest community in our area.
If you don't have broadband, what does it mean for your viability of that? It's admittedly small, but nevertheless, that's your population. If you don't have broadband and you look out to the out years, what are the implications?
Oh, we'll be dying on the vine. If you don't have reliable broadband, no one's going to want to relocate their business here or expand their business or kids that go away to college and then want to come home, but they don't want to come back to a community that doesn't have high-speed internet, something that they're used to. It impacts our education. We have a small school, like 150 kids, K through 12. a lot of those classes, they take a lot of classes online that limits their ability. And what your guest had said earlier about education going online, you know, the kids that are living out in the ranches, as soon as they leave town, their services diminish. And so, you know, there's challenges with then them continuing their finishing their education. And then, you know, then we have the whole thing about like teacher recruitment and bringing workforce into our community that doesn't have services that other places do.
Pretty soon, it does begin to sound almost like electricity in terms of viability. Betsy Blecka there in Jackson County, Colorado, the commissioner there. I mean, we've got lots of response online here. Rachel writes to us, "My family lives in an internet desert. We moved here a year ago, and it's tough. You can tell a difference. Folks around here literally don't know how to Google it." She says, "I'm gobsmacked daily. Hashtag rural Oklahoma." It's not just Colorado. It's lots of parts of the country. Here's another listener online says, "I think internet high speed equal open free internet is a human right. It's education. Education should be a human right." Claire Malone there in New York, you're looking at cities as well. I mean, Washington, the District of Columbia, you've got only 28.8% of adults with home internets at fast speeds. You're looking in the Bronx, New York, 35%, Manhattan. Only 35.6% of that kind of access there. That really surprised me, Claire.
Yeah,
you're in a just about as urban as you can get area of this country.
Yeah, you know, I think when we were looking at the numbers, we all expected a lot of places in rural America to have bad internet. But what really did strike me was how bad a lot of America's biggest cities are. And D.C. is actually the worst big city in the country, which is ironic, as I'm sure your listeners might pick up.
So many people there are super wired.
Super wired, super wealthy. It's an incredibly wealthy area. Its suburbs are what we call a super zip, you know, some of the wealthiest areas in the country. But what it really comes down to is a lot of people, a lot of people have cell phones, have smartphones. That's not the problem. But, you know, it's costly to have a home internet connection. But what prevents a lot of people from going online, particularly in cities, is pretty much a lack of digital literacy is a good way to put it, which is they might not have been familiar with setting up an email account in their lives. You know, they might not have learned how to cut and paste or word process, things that a lot of us might take for granted. But if you didn't learn it in school, or if no one's emphasizing it to you and teaching you at home, you might lose out. And I will just say one thing when we're talking about rural internet access and urban internet access and sort of that ineffable value of the internet. The internet is a network, and a network is inherently enhanced by the number, you know, as more and more people come on, as more and more points of view come into it.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know what we're losing if we don't have, you know, Latinos from the Bronx or people from rural America, if they don't have the opportunity to participate in our network. So all of America is losing out if these communities aren't connected. It's you know, that's what makes a network work, a lot of these voices coming on.
And of course, if you're not richly in it, then our inequality problems seem only destined to increase. I mean, if you don't have access to what makes the whole country run, you're in trouble. Claire, stand by there in New York. Betsy Blecka, stand by in Jackson County, Colorado. Kathy's calling from Nashville. Kathy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I worked at two different libraries, one year each, one in a rural setting and one in an urban setting.
Mm-hmm.
And the computers were such a necessity in both locations. People use them to download their paycheck stubs, to just use the email, to type things for school. But they were a necessity.
And how did it work?
It was great. We did have to assist them on setting up emails, just even how to click on a mouse and watch the cursor.
And how was what about the speed? Did you have good speed with your connections?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at both libraries we did.
Even in the rural area?
Yeah. Yeah, and we also, people could check out what they're called hotspots. And they can take them and they can access the internet at home. It's just like a USB that you hook up to your computer.
Yeah, yeah. If you can get one, you bring it right there. Kathy, I appreciate your call. I mean, Claire, there's a librarian attesting to the importance of it, but she didn't seem to be having that many problems with it.
Well, I think a misperception that a lot of people have about rural internet is that no one has the internet. For a lot of people, it's maybe slow in their homes, but they'll have libraries that are good connections. And so everyone will kind of crowd there after school, or people will go there. And librarians are the front lines in teaching people this digital literacy that we're talking about. So a lot of institutions might, you know, the town might invest funds in making sure that their library is up to snuff. But I think the one, you know, when we're talking about just having the ability to, you know, go and access your pay stub, as she said, or check your bank account balance, whatever it is, or, you know, helping your children research a project after school. I was thinking when I was writing this piece how, you know, when I was in elementary school and high school, I wasn't using the computer that much for research, but I had a parent who was willing to, if I needed to, drive me to the library to look something up. You know, a lot of parents, maybe you're working a night shift and you can't take your kid to the library. So a lot of this, you know, it's giving your kid access, not to Facebook, not just to Facebook or Netflix, you know, but also the idea of, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica is online now. Merriam-Webster is online now. There's a whole host of things that, you know, especially for educational purposes, I think a lot of kids could fall behind if they're not given these resources on a continual basis.
Claire and Betsy, please stand by. Sharon Strover joins us right now from Austin, Texas. She's professor of communications at University of Texas, Austin, directs the Telecommunications and Information Policy Institute there. Sharon Strover, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Hello.
Hi. Lots of people with broadband access, but also a lot of people who don't have it. How do we begin to get everybody in the game here? Can it be treated like electricity was, like telephone access was? Is there a secret ingredient to getting everybody on board? Is it just money? Is it economical? What do you see, Cher?
I think it's pretty complicated, really. Money is a part of it. Money in terms of what's needed to actually build these infrastructures. Mm-hmm. And some of them are more expensive than others. So when you were talking earlier about fiber is pretty expensive to deploy on the ground, buried. Even if it's strung on poles, it's way more expensive than a lot of the spectrum using technologies. But it's technologies and their attendant costs. It's the affordability of services, whether it's cable-based internet service in towns or cities, or whether it's cell phone services with data plans. I come up against this over and over again in the work and the research that I do. People just can't afford a lot of these data plans. And then beyond that, the terrain is also what happens on the federal level, what happens on the state level, and even what happens on the local level. And that was a great story about how local people can get together and work hard to try to move the needle a little bit in order to get better internet. And I've heard stories like that. As well.
You mentioned spectrum, and I guess there you mean the frequencies used for radio or television. I got a little tape here of Microsoft's president, Brad Smith. This was in July. He was announcing a Microsoft plan to use unused TV channels, known as white spaces or spectrum out there, to get more of rural America online. Here was the Microsoft president said a new national commitment is needed.
The time has come. We need a new approach as a nation to close this broadband gap. We didn't settle for less when it came to electrifying the country. We didn't say, let's leave 10% of the population behind. They'll get electricity someday. We didn't settle for less, even though it took long for the telephone. We should not settle for less today.
Of course, broadband access, good for Microsoft business, but good for the country as well. Professor Strover, what's he talking about? How do you use unused TV channels or spectrum to get broadband out there? How might you?
Well, when television stations moved to digital, a lot of the frequency that they were using for analog signals was no longer necessary. And this became what is now called white spaces. It is unlicensed spectrum. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of advantages in rural areas, at least, of being underutilized right now. I mean, white spaces is relatively new. So people, technology companies, and scientists are trying to figure out what exactly is the best use and what we can do with it. But Microsoft's experiment joins some other experiments in rural areas in which a relatively low-cost deployment could be used to reach people in the middle of nowhere, people, households, farms, other resource industries.
Is it as fast as fiber optic cable?
No. No, it would not be as fast.
Would it qualify as broadband? Would it hit that 25 up, 3 down?
I'm not sure. You know, I've talked to some scientists with some new methods of working with signals in white space, and it may be getting closer, but it's not quite at that 25.3 threshold as far as I know. But there are a lot of, I think it is really so complicated. And so the terrain literally and metaphorically is very bumpy here in terms of regulations, in terms of technology, in terms of digital literacy skills and abilities, and in terms of what anchor institutions like libraries and schools can do right now. Just to echo what somebody else was saying with respect to broadband service, a lot of people don't have consistent broadband service. They have a little bit at home. They have to run out to McDonald's to do something if they're on the go. It's a matter of kind of cobbling together what could pass for adequate access.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the digital divide, as nearly everything seems to be moving online. We're talking about who has broadband access and who doesn't in America's countryside, in its cities, and what to do about that. Claire Malone is with us, senior political writer for 538. She's been writing about all this. Betsy Blecka is here, county commissioner in Jackson County, Colorado. She put us on to this with a suggestion on our webpage, On Point Listens, there at onpointradio.org. We paid attention. She's had improvement in her county. Sharon Strover looks at all of this, rural and urban, from her seat. She directs the Telecommunications and Information Policy Institute at the University of Texas, Austin. You can join us this hour. What do you see here? Are you in off in the woods on vacation and glad to be disconnected? Or are you one of the millions of Americans, urban and rural, who just don't have good, consistent broadband access? How does it affect your life, your community? Betsy, Claire, Sharon, lots of response from people online here. Sal says on Twitter, I didn't have internet growing up. I got it at age 20. It was like I was living in the dark ages, in the dark until then. Rachel says moving into an internet desert was life-changing. Separation from family, friends, Facebook. Depression, loneliness is real. I guess once you're on it, you don't want to be off, maybe. But it's very practical, too. Wendy says higher ed is moving online. Students and instructors need access to quality internet to deliver quality education. It's an economic issue as well here. Freethink writes, have experience in here in northeast Vermont. I had problems selling my parents' property because there's only dial-up expensive satellite or through cell service to the internet. This problem lowers the value of properties. You can't have a modern business there. Steve writes to us from way off. He says, I'm in a small farming town in Norway. I have fiber right into my living room. The whole town has had it and has had it for a decade. And another listener writes on Twitter, Americans tolerate expensive, slow internet because they haven't seen how much better it is in other countries. We should look at that. Fonda in Dunlap, Iowa. Fonda, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm from small town farming community, rural Iowa.
Yeah.
And our telephone provider for the town has what I call a monopoly. In order to get internet, you have to have a house telephone through the telephone company in order to get your internet. And the internet is not even fiber optic high speed. It's just a step above dial-up.
Yep.
And at our public schools, the kids now have what's called Chromebooks. And we are a very big farming community, rural community.
Yep.
So the only way you can get internet out in the country is if you have it through your satellite television provider or you use your cell phone for a hotspot. So it gets very, very expensive and very spotty is a way to put it. It's very tough. We do not even have cable TV providers in our town. You either do satellite or you have just your regular television.
What's it mean for your education of kids there, Fonda?
It's very hard because we do have quite a few people that live below the poverty line. So they cannot afford to have internet. So the kids have to either go to the public library or go to their grandparents' house, like my daughter had to do her homework, or go to a friend's house.
Betsy Blicke, you're listening there in Colorado. Does this sound familiar to you, Betsy? Fondest story from Iowa.
Oh, absolutely. We face the same challenges. Starting from the monopoly to the impact that it has on the education with the reduced service or in the coverage once you leave town. Now, we don't have a cable company either. They just left. They just cut wires and left one day about 10 years ago.
Sharon, that's the rural problem, and we see how quickly it can get exclusive. On the rural side, on the urban side, what's most important here? Is it cost? Is it awareness? I mean, Claire Malone says a lot of people just aren't computer literate, but that seems, you would think that their kids, if they have the resources at all, would gravitate toward that and sort of pick it up and introduce it into families. Is it awareness or is it the cost in urban settings?
Cost is what we see is the overwhelming factor that leads people toward really valuing that those little free Wi-Fi spaces. And when we talk to people in New York City, in fact, it's a story of which hotel lobby you can get free Wi-Fi in, how long you can stay in Starbucks, how uncomfortable you feel walking into a commercial place just to use the Wi-Fi when you don't have the money to actually buy something there. There's a lot of social stigma, especially in a metro area where you see everybody on their cell phones with data plans, and you know you don't have that. There's an issue of digital dignity going on there, and among some of the urban populations. If I could weigh in on one of the rural commentaries, I spent some time in Sweden last fall looking specifically at broadband because I saw these amazing statistics on how widespread fiber networks are, and I learned that the government of Sweden basically for these uneconomic rural areas way up in the north says they just get out of the way and they let communities do what they want to do. And they don't put barriers in front of them in terms of, say, state regulations that prohibit any municipal involvement in telecommunications, which is the case here in the United States in many of our states.
What kind of barriers do we have up to? What options would be available if we didn't?
Well, I think one barrier that the FCC was beginning to address last year is precisely the state-level prohibition on any kind of municipal involvement and ownership running of telecommunications or internet provision.
Towns who
facilities.
Were saying, we're going to provide this to our town, and they stepped in and said, no, why?
Absolutely. And the case of Chattanooga was in the news recently, and they won basically an exception there so that they could, in fact, have the utility company provide very high-speed internet.
What's the opposition to this, though? Ideological or business or economic interest?
It's business.
Why?
It's primarily business because larger companies would prefer to control that sort of access. The question that I always ask with rural areas is, if they're not willing to serve those regions, why not just get out of the way?
Yeah.
And let communities and let other tiers of providers move in there. I'm very happy to see some movement by the utility co-ops in rural areas. They seem to be more and more interested. And they have rights of way. They have poles. They have expertise. They have trucks.
Yeah.
So I think we can perhaps expect some good things from utility companies and from the co-ops as well. And that's where co-ops are rather different from the Microsofts and the AT&Ts in the sense that co-ops are organized to serve communities. Well, they can make a profit. The profit goes right back into the operation, into the community. And that's not the case with for-profit companies.
Jerry in North Lauderdale, Florida. Jerry, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thank you, Tom. I hear that there's one of the primary issues with getting better broadband out in the rural areas and even in some of the cities. As an example, Chattanooga, Tennessee wanted to get increases in broadband. They wanted better service. They wanted to get it out into the rural areas. They were being fought by AT&T and the other types of providers from doing it themselves. They managed to succeed and put in their own broadband network that goes everywhere. It is 10 times faster than anything that the broadband companies are willing to do. They want to keep it at the lower levels. I guess they make more money that way. AT&T and the other companies have, in fact, tried to suppress the news of what Chattanooga did. You don't hear about it anywhere. The new FCC rules that are coming in are favoring the broadband companies from, in fact, having to upgrade.
Wow. We don't want to hear that. Claire, do we have commercial interest actually sitting on the possibility of faster access for many?
So one thing I will say is that, you know, I'll echo the comment about rural electric co-ops and small businesses, small local businesses that take on this broadband internet problem being a key component to getting more competition in these rural areas. So when I was out in Sawatch County, the San Luis Valley Rural Electric Cooperative was starting to get into broadband. And within Sawatch County itself, there was a small business that had sort of taken over and was providing internet to areas that the large telecom company had been ignoring. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these companies said, you know, the Rural Electric Co-op and this small broadband business that started to compete with the big telecom, they said they were frustrated because often they were sort of ignored for government money, for federal funds, and that the bigger telecoms would get the money and then not spend it on the rural areas. So I do think that there is a little bit of there's a need for perhaps more attention to be paid to these local local companies in these rural places that see this as sort of a public good, because it doesn't make economic sense for these bigger companies to go to these small places. I think that's fair to say from a business perspective. But we're also looking at this from a civic perspective. And so there are these rural electric cooperatives who have their roots in, let's go back to this rural electrification of FDR. You know, a lot of the government was gave those places funds to sort of help electrify the country, you know, the countryside. Mm-hmm. So there is a problem with competition in these very small areas where it doesn't make economic sense for big companies to go to.
Courtney in Nashville. Courtney, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a quick comment about this idea and to reiterate that the internet is not, it's not a luxury. It's not something that's just for entertainment. I'm from a very small town of 2,000 people, and then I went to a very large town when I worked my way through college, and now I'm in graduate school in the mm-hmm. same larger town. Mm-hmm. And internet is a way that you find housing or find a job or pay your bills or do your banking. It's not just something that's for fun. And so when we're talking about these things, it is actually a necessity the way that electricity is, because it is almost impossible to exist in the economy, whether it's for a job or just for education, without it.
It's more and more true. There's just no question about it. It doesn't matter if you're from a city or a town of 2,000, as you are, Courtney. And I appreciate your sort of just witness on that. Let me get one more right here. Thank you, Courtney. Moberly, Missouri. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that comment. As a business consultant working with companies, even on an international basis, that are looking for locations for new investment, internet access is a huge factor, very closely to access to talent. And as it relates to the rural communities, if you don't have those kinds of things that the young folks are looking for, namely internet access, you don't get to recruit the talent. Therefore, you're not able to have that conversation with that company about making the investment in expanded operations in one's community.
So just a kind of a fundamental platform that companies want to be in place to come in.
It's as important infrastructure, as the lady from Colorado mentioned, as sewer and water are.
I mean, Betsy Blecka in Colorado, I guess that's exactly the feeling you have there as Jackson County Commissioner.
Absolutely. It's just as important as all of our other utilities, sewer, water, electricity.
And David in Missouri, just facing that head on. I mean, Sharon, this is indeed more than just a personal challenge here. It becomes a community challenge. Whether urban or rural, if you don't have that access, you're not going to be able to lure big companies in there or any companies with the same ease.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even as we consider areas like agriculture, which on the face of it, you might think, oh, what do they need technology for? One of Microsoft's experiments with white spaces involves partnering with a phone co-op in Kansas that's working with a farmer who does precision agriculture. And that involves a lot of RFID technology and a lot of very careful tracking and monitoring using sensors. And you need some internet access in order to do that. So a lot of industries, you know, are predicated on some kind of connection to the internet.
Do you see policy coming together between local, state, and federal to make this happen? Is there a concerted enough effort? We heard Donald Trump talk about it. We hear the FCC chair, Ajit Pai, talk about it. But do you see actual policy coming together to make it a reality, Sharon?
Not yet. No, I don't. There are talks and there's, you know, dollar figures thrown out, but I haven't seen anything yet. And, you know, under the Obama administration, we had twin programs about roughly $9 billion was allocated for broadband. It was run through two agencies, agriculture and another one called the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, NTIA.
Mm-hmm.
And they had money for 3 years, and they pushed it out very quickly to projects that on the face of it looked very, very helpful. Unfortunately, we still don't really know exactly what those programs accomplished. What I would love to see is an effort that puts not only needed capital, but also unites local and state and federal folks and is really geared to assessing what kind of investments we want to make and what we plan to get out of it, and then figuring out, well, 5 years down the line, did we actually achieve that? And that's something that we didn't do.
Yeah, Claire, a lot of talk about this big infrastructure bill. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. You're watching Washington a little here. Is it clear that there would be money in that bill if and when it ever comes to pass, Trump's infrastructure for more universal broadband access?
Well, just to echo what's been said, there are very vague plans for broadband outside of it will be in this infrastructure bill that is not yet written, that there seems to be no real political will to push through right now on Capitol Hill. So there have been committee hearings, and I'd encourage Senate committee hearings, and I'd encourage listeners to go. And if they live in a rural area, you know, read the testimony of some of these internet experts who are talking about, you know, we don't want to replicate building some of the infrastructure that was already sort of used in the 2009, 2010 era sort of internet projects. But there's not a lot of coherent bill writing being done right now on infrastructure. So it's all kind of in its nascent stages in Washington.
Betsy Blecka, Jackson County Commissioner in Colorado, you got busy getting us focused on this, getting your own community focused on it. Sounds like you broke through. That may be the way for now. We really appreciate your giving us a heads up and joining us today, Betsy. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the attention. Appreciate it.
And Sharon Strover at the Telecommunications and Information Policy Institute, the University of Texas, Austin. Thanks for being here today, Sharon.
You're welcome.
Claire Malone, senior political writer at 538, wrote The Worst Internet in America. You can read that and more at our website, onpointradio.org. Claire, thanks very much for your work and for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.